all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good evening, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I have the privilege of being your host this evening. I am a former warrant officer helicopter pilot, 195th Assault Helicopter Company, Republic of Vietnam, 1969. I'm going to start off on a little bit of a downer, and I don't want you to get too upset with me today, but Robin Williams, as many of you know, committed suicide this last week, and it was such a shock to me. Because on our very first program back in 2003, we opened the program up with me doing his Adrian Kronauer, Good Morning Vietnam. And I was thinking about how am I going to honor this man today, because he has done so much to help America as far as our humor is concerned. I mean, the guy was a crazy when it talked to, talk about improvisation and so on and so forth. He's the Jonathan Winters of our generation. And I was just so impressed by his humor and especially his dedication to veterans. And I don't know how many of you are aware of how often he was off to Iraq and Afghanistan with the USO doing their shows, meeting with the troops, men and women. And I've gotten emails from people who served over there saying what a wonderful man he was. And I just wanted to pay homage to him a little bit today because he was such an influence in so many of our lives, and I'm sure that he brought a smile to many of our lives. The other thing I wanted to bring up in talking about Robin was to talk about suicide, which is something that many of us don't want to talk about at all. And if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking with our friends who put the crosses up to pay respect to the men and women who have unfortunately committed suicide as a result of Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and they're coming home at 22 a day. And there was a story on the news this morning that was talking about 38,000 Americans commit suicide every year. And there's no way that we can stop some of these people, but I just wanted to remind you out there, if you see something happening with one of your friends or family members, please almost do your own little intervention and say, what's going on? Is there something that we can talk about? How are you doing? Keep in touch with these people, because we never know what makes people depressed, what makes people get to that point where they're willing to take their lives. So many of us think, well, gee, I would never do that. And how many people do we know that have done that? So I just wanted to point that out to you, and I wanted to remind everybody to call this National Suicide Hotline if you're having problems or you know somebody who's having problems. The National Hotline is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Surprisingly, the Veterans Suicide Crisis Hotline is also 800-273-8255, but you press number 1 and they'll send you directly to counselors from the VA. So that number again, for anybody out there who's thinking about it or you know somebody who is having some problems, have them give them a call. That's 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. If you're a veteran, press number 1. They'll put you right in touch with somebody who can understand a little bit more about your issues that you have that maybe you've been going through. So that's it for Robin Williams. You made us laugh, man. I really do appreciate that. And I think we're going to miss you quite a bit, quite a bit. On a little bit more upscale note, we've got a program that's coming up not only today, but that's coming up in a couple of weeks up in a local little town here in Michigan, in Hamburg, Michigan, and it's going to be the Moving Wall. And many of you around the country are familiar with the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C. Well, they're bringing in kind of a little scaled-down version of it, and if you've seen it, it's just as powerful as the one in Washington, D.C. And joining me on the line right now is our guest, Joanna Hardesty, and Joanna is kind of heads up the whole thing. So, Joanna, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me this evening.
It is a pleasure to talk to you, and I'd really want to find out a little bit more about this traveling wall. Can you tell me a little bit what you're going to be doing up in Hamburg?
I sure can. Well, the traveling wall does travel. It's called the Vietnam Memorial Moving Wall, and it is based out of White Pines, Michigan, actually, but it does travel the United States. And it's coming to Hamburg from Louisiana over Labor Day weekend. and it's a half-scale version of the wall that is in Washington, D.C.
And can you tell me some of the events that you've got lined up? I noticed that it's going to be arriving on, what is it, the Thursday, the 28th?
That is correct. It will be arriving by escort, motorcycle escort. We have the Patriot Guard riders heading that up. We'll be leaving Brighton, and we're going to take a 26-mile hike from Brighton to Amberg, even though we're just a couple miles away, just so we can get through neighborhoods and areas so people can see us coming through. As I said, it will be led by the Patriot Guard riders and any volunteers that would like to participate in that. We're going to meet in Brighton at the Cracker Barrel about 8 o'clock. Our plans are to take off from there about 10 a.m. on Thursday, the 28th. Mm-hmm. We will be arriving to the park somewhere around 11:30 noon, depending on how many escort riders we have with us. And we will be setting up at that point in time about noon. Our plan is to arrive and begin setting the wall up at that time.
Do you need any volunteers for that?
We do. Absolutely do. And they're just asked to meet us there at Merrill Park. Actually, it's Bennett Park on Merrill Road in Hamburg Township. If you just meet us there, if you want to be involved with that, it's an amazing process to see it all come together and be a part of putting it together.
I would think so. I was going to ask you, how do you...
We also have many other things going on at the same time. Our purpose in bringing it is to show tribute to our fallen soldiers, Vietnam soldiers, and their families, as well as all veterans who have served and that we have lost and their families. And we really want to keep the history of all of that alive and our kids and our grandkids, everybody to see what's going on. So we've set up some displays that will be a part of this as well. We've got some educational displays that we're calling living history encampments and vehicles for World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, of course, the Persian Gulf through current conflicts. We also will have a restored Vietnam veteran Huey helicopter on display and an opportunity to take a flight in that.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. So supposing I wanted to go up there since I haven't taken a ride. Well, I take that back. I did take a ride a couple of years ago at the Yankee Air Museum, but I wanted to take another ride in a Huey. Is this a free ride, or is there a fee involved?
There is a fee involved. The reason is it's being brought to us by a nonprofit organization that also does this throughout the country. Their purpose is to restore these helicopters, and they're in the process of creating a museum. And they are as a 501c3, the cost involved is to buy a one-year membership with their organization, and that is $100 for the year, and then that'll get you a free ride in the Huey while it's here.
Okay. Well, I guess I better go check and see what's going on with my penny collection to see what I might need for that. I can tell people out there that there's nothing – I don't know. I'm prejudiced, obviously, here, but there's nothing better than a ride in a helicopter. It's like a magic carpet ride because you're just sitting there, possibly your feet are dangling out over the sky and the ground and everything else, and if the pilot does a kind of a sharp turn one way or the other, you're looking straight at the ground, and there's nothing between you and the ground. It's pretty exciting. But I saw that there are a whole bunch of other things going on during this thing. We're talking with Joanna Hardesty, and you can find more information for our listeners out there at the travelingwallhamburg.org, correct?
The Moving Wall.
The
Hamburg.
Moving Wall. Oh, darn, I'm getting too old for this stuff. But the movingwallhamburg.org. So we'll make sure that I understand you have a little USO show.
We do. We have invited a Bob Hope impersonator from Las Vegas, actually, to come in and put on a USO show, a couple of them, on Friday and Saturday night. And we're ramping that up with a few other surprise guests from those times, impersonators, of course, with a couple of bands that we'll be playing. This will be held on the opposite side of the park from where the wall is, so that we have the solemn environment over by the wall. And then across the way on the stages at the park, we will have a little bit of a lighter side going in a trip down memory lane and bring back some memories. Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Jimmy Durante,
Red Skelton, and so many of the other ones. I was listening to some of Bob Hope's things today when I was thinking about Robin Williams, and it's just amazing what these men and women did, gratis. They just went over and put themselves into a war zone to entertain the troops, and it's such an adventure for us to be able to see these people, put on these presentations for us. And then, today's generation of the great country singers and comedians and things that have been traveling around the world. So thank goodness for the USO continuing, their service and their work that they are doing. So, all right, so we're going to be coming up to Hamburg, and we're, for people around southeastern Michigan, where the heck is Hamburg?
Well, we are.
Good, you live there. How do I get there from here?
actually, just travel US 23 south to M36. It's exit 53 off of US 23, and then just follow the sign.
Follow the sign. So those of us in the local Ann Arbor, the southern part of the state, we'll go north on US 23 and
north. I travel south to Ann Arbor. So.
Well, everything.
You're right.
Everything is so far
Thank
away.
You.
And this begins on Thursday, August 28th, with the wall being transported from Brighton to Hamburg. So if you want to observe that, I'm sure that you can go to the website, themovingwallhamburg.org, and the schedule is up there, the route that they're taking, and everything else is available to you. And this show runs through Monday, Labor Day, correct?
All the way through the night, Monday, Labor Day. Our closing ceremony will be held on Monday evening at 7 o'clock, but we will have the wall open and available for visitors throughout the night. We will be dismantling the wall about 8 o'clock on Tuesday, September 2nd.
Okay. And I see that your closing ceremony includes bagpiper. Oh, no. Ooh, bagpiper, rifle salute, and taps. Joanna, thank you very much for doing this. I know you're the guiding force behind this whole thing, and you've been doing it for, almost 12 years now. And I want to thank you for doing this for all the veterans in the local area, and I plan on coming out there and meeting you in person.
Thank you. I look forward to it, and thank you for your service and all the veterans out there. My gratitude.
Thank you. And we'll be right back after this with our guest, Bob Timberg, whose story is A Blue-Eyed Boy, and boy, you better stay tuned and listen to this one, because it's really powerful. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Are you a military veteran? Do you need help finding out about your benefits? With over 600 veterans in Michigan, many don't have the proper information to obtain the benefits they are entitled to. All Michigan veterans are invited to attend the Canton Community Foundation's annual Veterans Summit. Topics will include VA and healthcare eligibility, pension, and disability benefits. This free event will be held Wednesday, September 10th at Laurel Manor in Livonia. Registration is required. To register, go to cantonfoundation.org.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and I got to correct that ad. There's 600,000 veterans in Michigan, so I'll have to talk to Robert about that. But joining me right now on the air is Bob Timberg, and Bob is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He served in Vietnam, and we'll get into that a little bit more as we go along. He's also an award-winning author and an award-winning writer for the Washington Post. So, Bob Timberg, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. I hate to start this by correcting you.
Oh, me?
But it is little boy who is
blue-eyed boy
for the Washington Post. I worked for the Baltimore Sun.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, my son Craig.
I know that. The kid who
bullied me into writing this book.
Oh, okay. That's the one that works for the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Okay. See, I just read the flap for it, and I'm going, oh, I knew somebody worked out there somewhere.
Yeah, right.
But anyhow, so Bob's book is The Blue-Eyed Boy, and where did you get the title for Blue-Eyed Boy?
The title comes from a poem by E.E. Cummings that is usually known by its first line, which was Buffalo Bill's defunct. Cummings did not routinely give his poems titles.
Mm-hmm.
But the title of my book comes from the last line of that poem, which is, "How do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death?" And it was essentially what I was saying was, "Hey, I beat you, Death."
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly did.
At least for a time.
Well, we're all still working at that one.
Right.
So, tell me how you your military career started. I know that you went to Annapolis to the Naval Academy. What made you decide to do that?
Well, for most of us that went into the service academies, there's usually some sort of odd story. You know, few of us, I think, had, you know, straight line reasons. In my case, it was partially a desire to serve my country. But it was not just that. It was also, it was a desire to get away from a home that was dangerous in some ways and difficult. And there was also a sense that I needed to be different from my father.
Mm-hmm.
Who was a wonderful man, extremely talented, far more talented than me, but who at that point in my life I thought of as very timid, and I thought of his timidity as being torpedoing his promise. And it just seemed to me that I needed to do something that was tougher.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was a good baseball player, but I played football in high school. And instead of going to a civilian college, I said, "Well, what's the heck, right?" Then after that, you know, it was, well, all right, now we're getting ready to graduate. What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
I had a choice between the Navy and the Marine Corps, so I went into the Marine Corps.
Yeah, which is tougher, right? The Navy or the Marines?
Seems to me.
I don't know.
You know, I guess
the
SEALs might argue this.
Point, yeah, I was going to say at that time. I have to point out to our audience that when did you go to the Naval Academy? What years were you there?
Yeah, I graduated in 1964, so that was, you know, I was there.
You were there when Navy and Army was really, they were big football powers at the time.
Well, actually, my class, the class of 1964, had Heisman Trophy winners as bookends. When we were plebes, freshmen, the Heisman Trophy winner was a Navy running back named Joe Bellino.
Right.
And when we were first class or seniors, the Heisman Trophy winner was a quarterback named Roger Staubach.
I think we've heard of him.
And in throughout those entire 4 years, Navy never lost to Army. Not once.
Rub it in. You describe in your book, we're talking with Bob Timberg, who's author of Blue Eyed Boy, a memoir. He talks about his decisions to go to Annapolis and talks about his growing up, what his mom was like, what his dad was like, and so forth. And I don't need to get into those details because we all have issues with our parents. And
you know what I believe, Dale? I believe the true test of maturity is when you stop blaming your parents for your problems.
I agree 100%, you know, because they did the best that they could. And
true. I think that's right.
And, you know, it's up to us to take whatever, you know, whatever we got from them and put it into practice, and hopefully we can make things a little bit better. But that's enough of that philosophy for right now. I'm getting off on all kinds of tangents, and I haven't even started yet.
Well, actually, your previous guest, who was talking about helicopters, and I know you were a helicopter pilot, I can tell you that I, you know, am forever grateful to helicopters, which took me from lying on a battlefield in South Vietnam to a station hospital near Da Nang, which was probably about 20 miles, and I think the chopper was the difference between life and death for me.
Well,
so you never hear me say a bad word about a helicopter or a helicopter pilot.
It was, you know, just like all of us over there at that time, we were doing our job, and we would do anything possible to save each other's lives, didn't make any difference if we were in the air or if we were on the ground. I've got a shirt on, an Army Aviation School shirt on right now, and on the back it says, above the best. And that's the way we look at it.
That's wonderful. I'd never heard that.
That's
terrific.
Yeah, that's the way we all felt, you know. But anyway, all right, so now that you've mentioned that story, I think we can get into really what the whole book is about, at the beginning of your journey. So there you are. You're in Vietnam. This was in what year were you there?
This was 1966 into January of 1967, where I had a run-in with a Viet Cong landmine.
And
landmine one.
How much more time did you have in country to go when this happened?
I had 13 days to go. And this was a Marine Corps tour. Marines in those days.
I know, you guys were tough. You were there 13
months. Army
yeah.
had 12 months.
Just because. But and this
just because Marines thought that, you know, they would show how much tougher they were.
True. But actually, this was this mission that you went out on where you ran into this landmine was one you weren't supposed to be on. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this was for an infantry officer. What I was on, it was an administrative chore, which was paying the troops, which is what the Marine Corps, and I'm guessing the Army,
does
every 2 weeks, even in the bush, and assuming they're not in hostile contact. They could be in hostile territory, but if you can get a pay officer out there, you get him out there, and he pays them. And I was riding on a track vehicle called an Amtrak, which is similar to the Army's armored personnel carrier, and I had a little bag, a little canvas bag with all these bills that were the size of dollar bills, but were called military payment certificates.
Yeah, the Monopoly money.
Yeah, and you know they had on the face of these bills, you know, in the place of, you know, Old Hickory or Honest Abe or George Washington, you know, there was a woman's face, and I swear it was Jackie Kennedy.
It could be. I have to go home tonight and see if I have a couple of those things left.
Take a look.
I'll take a look at it. So you're out in the field, and you're going to go out and deliver this money to the guys who are out there, you know, in the bush. And unfortunately, you run into this landmine. Let me remind our audience that we're talking to Bob Timberg, author of Blue Eyed Boy. And you can give us a call if you have a question here at in southeastern Michigan at 734-822-1600. Or you can call us toll-free at 844-VET-1600. That's VET-1600. So tell us
I can just interrupt. You asked me. I wasn't supposed to be doing it that day. That's right. I was not. I had 13 days left, and I was going to go on R&R that day, and I expected to be not sitting on the top of an Amtrak with this little bag of money. I expected to be in Okinawa looking at stereo equipment at the PXs there. But
right.
the officer that was supposed to be the pay officer that day for our company, something came up. It was a war, you know. I couldn't say, hey, you know, tell your platoon to, you know, put your platoon sergeant in charge and come back and be pay officer. You know, you can't do that. So I stepped in. I stepped in because the company commander told me to, and so I was the pay officer that day, and that's I was wounded. You know. As on the way out to the platoon position that you know, where the troops that I was supposed to pay were located.
We've got a couple of minutes, so we're going to take a break at the bottom of the hour. Can you tell me what you do remember of what happened when you went over that mine?
Sure. What I remember is I remember that. Before that, everyone said that road that we were on was like okay. Everyone, they had been going down it for a couple of weeks, but you know, I could see all these little holes. I mean, it was obviously not always well protected and safe. And I was, you know, I was not thinking about the fact that I was not looking at stereo equipment, because you can't get a, you can't do that when you go into hostile territory.
Right.
Look and see what's going on. We hit the mine, and all I know is I was flying through the air, and I felt as if I was engulfed in flames. And then I guess I hit the ground because I was out cold from that at that point. And there was a when I came to, the corpsman, what the Marine calls what medics,
right.
Army calls them medics, we call them corpsmen, was standing over me and saying, Lieutenant, are you okay? Are you okay? And I, and you know, I indicated that I was at least alive, and I also, you know, in fact, some of the close a sergeant and told him to put out a perimeter defense, because usually what happens when you have a, you know, something that disorganizes your unit, like a landmine, or you know, you do what they call cover it by fire. When people are running around like chickens with their heads cut off, you just mow them down.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted a perimeter defense out, and of course this was Marine Sergeant, and he said, "Sir, I've already done it." So
yeah, they have a tendency to jump into command positions right away.
Yeah, exactly. So there I was, you know, I was lying there, and the corpsman said, "You know, we've got a chopper coming in for you, so just hang loose." And he asked if I was in any pain, and I said, "Well, you know, not excruciating pain, but it, you know, it ain't terrific."
Okay, I'm sorry, I have to cut in here, Bob. We got to take a break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Don't miss this, Bob Timberg.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacobs drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His action saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Applebee's Restaurants is a proud sponsor of Veterans Radio. For the best in family dining, you'll want to make any Applebee's restaurant your destination for just plain good food, good service, and complimentary military discounts. So plan your next delicious out-to-dinner meal at Applebee's. That's Applebee's Restaurant. They help Veterans Radio deliver our program to you.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and I just wanted to remind you, our director, Nina, has been flashing these signs at me, making sure that you can follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. And, of course, some of you are listening to the program on the Internet on whamradio.com. If you need to give us a call or you want to give us a call, you can reach us at 734-822-1600 or toll-free 844-VET-1600. That's V-E-T-1600. I'm talking with Bob Timberg, author of The Blue-Eyed Boy, a memoir of what happened to him in Vietnam, and we're going to move ahead, as they say. Your Amtrak ran over a mine. You were blown to smithereens almost, but mostly you got burns almost over a large part of your body, but especially your face. Right, Bob?
Yes, that's right, Dale. And, you know, if I could just say one thing, this book does involve what happened to me in Vietnam, but that's only a small portion. What this book is about is recovery and reclaiming my life.
Absolutely. That's where we're going right now.
Okay.
All right.
I figured that.
You mentioned earlier on that you were medevaced out to Da Nang and then probably to, you know, Japan and then home. And in the story, you give this amazing explanation and narrative of the surgeries that you had to have, and that initially you thought that you were okay. Is that right?
You know, I did. I mean, I knew I was hurt, but I didn't know. I didn't know what was going on. You know, it was like, yeah, I was in pain, but then when I saw my face, which I knew had been most seriously burned, it was red. It looked like, in fact, looked like a raw steak.
Mm-hmm.
But all my features were intact. My nose looked like my old nose. My mouth looked like my mouth. And so I figured, once my skin grows back, you know, it'll be fine. Yeah, the thing I didn't know, though, was that, you know, when you have a third-degree burn, the skin doesn't grow back.
Mm.
And, what I had was a number of skin grafts. I mean, over the course of 35 operations, actually, I had a number of skin grafts, and they basically covered what had been my face, but I mean, it was more like, I kind of think of it as like effectively shellac,
mm-hmm.
just covering the, you know, and then it started to contract and harden the skin grafts and then start to pull. And this face that I had seen with features intact was being pulled in, you know, five different directions. And within a matter of a month or two, I was severely disfigured.
I don't know if it's more emotional for me or for you to even talk about this whole thing. Can you tell me about the role that your wife Janie played in bringing you back?
Yeah, I sure can. She certainly deserves it. The first thing she found out about was that I had been wounded, and then she tried to find out, well, where I was. And at one point, the Marine Corps told her that they had lost me. They didn't know where I was. And then she got some information that I was in Yokosuka, Japan, and she called there, asked to speak to the doctor treating Robert Timberg, and she was told that they had never heard of me. And, well, essentially, she found out correctly that I was in Army General Hospital in Yokohama. It was, in fact, the military burn center for the Far East. And she flew over, and she, against doctor's direction, and she was with me through all of this surgery. And, you know, there was, you know, she was there to cheer me on, to scold me when I, you know, got out of hand, when I started getting, you know, morbidly depressed,
mm-hmm.
or drinking, you know, which, you know, I had never done a lot of, and suddenly I was. And then, you know, when I had to go out at times, you know, between surgeries, I could go home for like a week or so. And it was important that I get out, that I walk, that I pick up a little strength. But see, when I went outside, there were people out there who looked at me and looked at me in a way that made me uncomfortable. And it sometimes in a way that infuriated me. And I would sometimes just explode at them, particularly if they were the parents of some little kid who was going around saying things like, look, Daddy, look at that man's face. And, you know, that was, I mean, of course I understood what was going on, but I would scream at the guy in a way that was, I think, threatening. And say, haven't you taught your kid not to stare at people? And Janie, my wife, said, you know, I understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, but you can't keep doing it. You just can't keep doing that. You know, the people are going to look funny at you. Okay, deal with it. Don't go berserk every time that happens, because it's going to keep happening. You know, maybe less and less as time goes on. But, you know, there's no way to live, you know, walking down the street and barking at every person that, you know, looks, gives you a sidelong glance.
What made you decide to go into journalism? And people, you're going to have to read this book, because his description of what he went through was so enlightening to me. And it's not that I was never wounded. I was very fortunate. I either ducked or was in the right place at the right time. But there were so many things that Bob brings up in his book, Blue Eyed Boy, that struck me or made me think of my experiences in the service and really kind of clarified a few things. So while you're recovering from these 35 different surgeries, and you had this great relationship with your doctor, who you followed him actually to when he got out of the service, is that right?
Well, there was a break after, first of all, he threw me out of the hospital. I was in San Diego Naval Hospital. And he said, you know, Bob, you know, I'm going to discharge you. You know, we've done a lot of surgery. Your skin has to heal. And it's not going to be a matter of weeks now. It's got to be a matter of a couple of years. Well, that really, you know, really, scared me. I mean, suddenly I was going to, I mean, a hospital had been a kind of haven for me, and I was going to lose that. At any rate, you know, I got out of the hospital. I went to graduate school. I learned to be a reporter. And then at a certain point, it was clear that I needed more surgery. And my doctor, Lynn Ketchum, who had been a Navy doctor, was out of the service. And it just seemed like Lynn was the guy that I wanted to do the work. And he was in Kansas City, and I was in Annapolis, Maryland. And so for about the next year, I would fly to Kansas City about once every 3 weeks and check into the hospital, to the University of Kansas Medical Center, and Lynn would go to work on me again. I mean, he reconstructed my face. I mean, this was that's what happened. And, you know, and I knew already how good he was, and I just felt this was the best place for me, and I think it was. And I've, you know, over the years, Lynn and I have kept in contact, and you know, and I treasure his friendship, but you know, at least as much as I treasure his expertise. And
well, it
my
sounded
gratitude
like
to him, it will
yeah,
never
it,
be, you know.
Yeah, it sounded like a great relationship to have. And God, an hour goes so fast. We got about 15 minutes to go, Bob. So you end up going to school, to journalism school, no less, and become a journalist, which I think is really interesting. And can you kind of briefly describe the move from there to eventually to the Baltimore Sun?
Sure. There was, of course, once Lynn Ketchum was going to, you know, send me, you know, discharge me, I had to come up with something to do, and Janie and I went over this and that and this possibility, that possibility, and she said, you know, at a certain point after we had been through about five or six things, what about journalism? And I said, yeah, I said, Janie, be serious. Do you think I'm going to go out on the street with a pen and a little notebook and walk up to people and say, hi, I'm Bob Timberg, and, you know, tell me what's going on? I said, not a chance. And she said, okay. So that went out the window for about 2 weeks. And then we still weren't coming up with anything. And she said, why don't you consider journalism again? And I said, no. She said, think about it. All these things that we talked about that you might have wanted to do, you can sort of write about all of them if you're a journalist. And somehow that made sense to me. And it was also the fact that I was a newspaper reader, and I liked reading stories, and I liked reading bylines and thinking about who the reporters were. So that's it. I said, okay, all right, let's take a chance. And I think of it as if I threw a dart, you know, and it landed on journalism.
No, at least it landed.
Next thing I know, I was at Stanford, and I was in a graduate program and learning a little bit of what reporters do.
It sounded like the dart landed in the right place for you. I need to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the stories that you've run into with your journalism, especially with your first novel about the other boys from Annapolis. So we'll be right back after these messages. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for five decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. And, Bob, we've got a caller on the line. Actually, it's a Robert, so I'm going to put Robert on the line. Robert, you had a comment?
Well, yes. I was just going to respond to your interview person there. This is Bob, I believe.
Yep.
And he was describing where he was, you know, logically lost during his medical treatment after being medevaced. I had a similar experience, except I was actually physically lost once I was medevaced out of. I was in a fire base, and we were an artillery battery in the boonies. And when I got medevaced out of there after an artillery duel, I got to tame in, and then they gave me some basic first aid, and they'd run out of anesthetics because of the number of casualties. And when they figured I was stable, they put about six of us on the back of a dump truck on stretchers and took us to various base camp units and dropped us off for routine follow-up. And they put me in an empty hooch because my unit was on temporary assignment to the 25th Infantry Division, and they put us in an empty – they put me in an empty hooch, and they lost me for 24 hours. Then it was – you know, I would describe it as minor shrapnel wounds, but because 24 hours of antibiotics, I developed severe cellulitis.
Oh my God.
That was interesting.
Well, you know, the military works in mysterious ways.
And I think, you know, I mean, my own feeling is that military medicine is really very, very good. But, you know, there's administrative things that happen, and guys get lost. That's what happened to us, right?
It does. Thank you, Robert. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. This is the first time I've called, and it's only the second time I've listened, but I'll be plugging you in every week.
Thank you very much. Robert, where are you listening from?
Wixom, Michigan.
Thank you very much for calling. We appreciate that. All right, Bob, well, back to you. You're now a graduate of Stanford. Pretty good school, I've heard. And you're going off to become a journalist. And how did that work out for you? I mean, obviously we know it worked out pretty well, but how did that work for you initially?
Well, you know, it was, you know, I said I had to do something, which meant I went to graduate school. Then there came the problem of having to actually get a job. Well, you know, I wasn't really sure I wanted a job for all the reasons I've already stated. I did not necessarily see myself running out and talking to people. But all my friends and all my classmates were applying for jobs, and I just got swept up in the momentum of it all. And, you know, so I started applying for jobs too. And you know, the funny thing is I really, truly didn't want a job. But I also didn't want not to get a job. I mean, I was working hard to get a job that I didn't really want. But, you know, I got one. And suddenly, one day, I'm sitting in a newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland, and at a desk, nominally a reporter, and something happens, and a lady jumps off a bridge, and the city editor looks at me and says, "Timber, go." And, you know, it was like I didn't know what to do other than go, and that's what I did.
And you've been going ever since, it sounds like.
I've been going ever since, that's right, yeah.
Did you find that the, I don't know, does reporting kind of fill in that adrenaline void that you had back when you were in the service? Or is,
you know, it really did. I mean, you know, H.L. Mencken, the great journalist from Baltimore and the Baltimore Sun, you know, called journalism the profession of kings. And, you know, it really is. It's not always fun, and it's not easy, and you can do a few things that are not good, like wreck your family life, which I did, actually, because you work so hard. But, man, there's truly nothing like it.
It sounds fascinating, and Bob, I need to have you back on because I want to talk about your other book about the other graduates of Annapolis, the Nightingale Song, and you wrote a great book about John McCain, and I don't know, I'm just really motivated to find out more about you. I think it's fascinating. Can you kind of tell me in a nutshell, the moment that you came to the decision to write this book, and what do you think motivated you to do that? And we can't quite get as colorful as you did in the book.
Okay, I will tell you that very briefly. I mean, there were a couple of things that told me, hey, this was the time, you know, this was the time to write this book, even though I had, you know, people had in the past had said, you know, why don't you write a book? And I'd say, not a chance. I'm never writing this book. But, you know, as the years went by, I began to sense that the nation had returned to a familiar place. We had deep divisions over unpopular wars and thousands of men and women bearing, you know, scars of combat were coming home. And, after a long career, I began to appreciate that my story echoed their stories. And, you know, it might help illuminate the true cost of combat to a nation that sometimes entered its wars a bit carelessly.
Well, I think.
And you know, my greater hope was that the tale that I told would show that with some courage and some luck, those who have paid for our recent military adventures with their arms or their legs or their skin might, you know, regain some of what they lost while serving their country.
This is the book for them to read, and I can certainly relate to that because I know when the latest conflict began, you know, 10 years ago or 11 years ago or whatever it was, there was an upsurge at the veterans hospitals from Vietnam veterans who were coming in complaining of anxiety attacks and just couldn't figure out why they were so upset at things. And it turned out that after, you know, when they were talking to their counselors and so forth, that it turned out that they saw so many similarities between the two conflicts, and it was so disturbing to them. I think the book is a great way for people to look into their own motivations and into their own thought process, and I think that they'll find it really fascinating. We're still talking to Bob Tinberg, author of The Blue-Eyed Boy, a memoir. And I guess, you know, you've talked about the idea of why you wrote the book and how much it helped and how you think it may help the next generation. What have you got coming up next? Have you got another one in you, do you think?
You know, I really don't, but I always, this is my fourth book, and after each one I've said, never again. And, you know, and this one, had it not been for my son Craig kicking me in the rear and saying, hey, come on, you've got to do something, I wouldn't have done this. So right now I'm basically, I think, at the mercy of Craig to come up with another great idea.
Well, you know, it's kind of fascinating when your family, especially your kids, get involved. And, you know, it's like, what did you do, Daddy, when you were growing up? Like, my son calls my time period the gray years because I've never really explained a lot of things that occurred during that time period. And maybe I should sit down and talk to him about those gray years, and we can, I don't know if there's a book in there, but there certainly is a story, which is why we do this program, is to get these stories out.
If I could just make one quick point here.
Sure.
Realized I needed to know things about my dad, and I started to do it, and then for some reason I got away from it, and you know, he died about 15 years ago, and I truly, truly regret that I did not do that.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, I just want to know, and I, you know,
you want to know who was this guy, and so forth, and my dad died when I was 15, but he'd been in the Coast Guard, and we found out in doing Veterans Radio, somebody called in and said that he had known my dad, and it was just mind-boggling because he sent me pictures and stories and things I didn't know anything about, and it was just so helpful to them. Bob,
the other thing was that especially World War II guys, you know, they just didn't seem to talk about their combat experiences.
No, they didn't, you know, and it's kind of interesting when you think about that they probably they didn't talk about it until they were much older, and then they finally they start telling these stories when they're in their late 70s and early 80s, and you're going, who the heck is this guy? I didn't know this happening to these people, and so, you know, it's incumbent upon people like you and those of us here at Veterans Radio to get these stories down and get them out, and hopefully we can, you know, pass these amazing men and women on to the next generation.
Well, it's just the idea that maybe that this will help somebody is, you know, it is really important to me. You know, I know what I went through, and I know how sad and depressed I got. And, you know, I beat that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't beat it by myself. I had help, but I beat it. And at least as much as I'm ever going to beat it, as, you know, I'm not on the same path I was on, the day I got wounded. But I think, you know, I think in the end, I feel like the path that I'm on is authentically my own.
It is. And I look upon you as a true American hero and a great writer. It's Bob Tinberg, Blue-Eyed Boy. Get out there and buy it. You can go through the Veterans Radio website. We'll have it up there for you there. This program, if you're just tuning in, we're going to have up on our website a little bit later on this evening, hopefully by tomorrow at the latest. Thank you, Bob, very much. I do want to have you back on.
Hey, thank you, Dale. It was my pleasure.
Okay. So for all of you out there, thank you, Nita. Thank you, Derek. We're going to be back next week with another story of heroism. And confronting injuries and things like that with another veteran, but this one's from Afghanistan and the war, and he was seriously injured. So that would be with Jim Falzone. So tune in next week. Until then, you are dismissed.